Welcome back to Aliyah Yomi. Today we're going to be learning Bo Revi, the fourth Aliyah in Parshas Bo. The topic of our Aliyah is the last plague in the first month. Our Aliyah is a little longer, 27 Sukkim, running from Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Dalet, to Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Chof. Let's take a look at the overview of the Aliyah, and then we'll delve into some deeper points to ponder. So we now are still in the middle of the conversation. Moshe Rabbeinu tells Paro Kachatzas Olala Niyotza B'Pesach Mitzrayim, and around midnight I'm going to go out over all of Egypt, and at that point in time all the firstborns are going to die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh to the firstborn of this maidservant who's working by the millstone. Even the firstborns of the animals are going to die, and there's going to be this crying out in the land of Egypt, which never before will ever has happened. And while this is happening, there'll be peace in the camp of Israel. There won't even not so much as a dog will bark. Everything will be quiet and peaceful. And you will then come to me, you'll bow down to us, and you will send us out. Paro, at this point in time, he left Paro in anger. So this clearly obviously must have happened before Paro chased him out as well. This conversation must have happened a little earlier, as we discussed in the last Aliyah. Hashem then says to Moshe that he's not going to listen to you, and the reason this is going to be is in order for me to be able to do all my miracles and signs as I wanted, and that's what Hashem does. Pharaoh refuses to send them, and this is now that ensues the last of the Makos. But before that happens, we hear the first national mitzvah given to the nation of Israel, and that is the beginning of Perek Yud Beis, where we hear Chodesh Hazelachem Rosh Chodeshim Rishon Hu Lachem LaChodesh Hashanah. This month is going to be the first of all the months of the year to you, and so they're told that on the 10th of the month, what they're supposed to do is take a Selah Beis, to take a lamb for every household, and they are going to, if they, let's say, a house cannot get it, then they will grab their neighbors and probably be part of their group, so that they will also be part of a group with a seh. And this has to be a one-year-old seh, whether it be a goat or a sheep. And they are supposed to keep it for 4 days until the 14th of the month. And at a point in time, all of Israel will sacrifice this goat. And they are to take the blood of the goat and put it on the two of the doorposts and on the door frame, so that they will be able to eat the roasted meat of this lamb or this goat on matzos and merorim, on these leavened breads, the unleavened breads and bitter herbs. And we hear a few rules about this. It cannot be cooked, this meat. It cannot be lightly seared. It has to be roasted, and nothing is allowed to be left over from it till the morning. And it has to be eaten in a state of sort of preparation, as because of the chipazon, because of the rush. And this blood is going to be as a protecting agent because of the danger, the mashchis, the destruction which is ensuing in the streets around them. And this will be the way they're going to celebrate this. And we also hear now about commands about not eating chametz, leavened bread, in the future, and guarding to make sure that all consumed grain products are unleavened as well. And the commands for the future Pesach are part of our Aliyah, 7 days of Pesach, and not eating any leaven, which seems to be repeated 11 times in different permutations, in different types of mitzvahs surrounding it as well. So a few points to ponder. Why is Moshe Rabbeinu describing this whole experience as kechatzai salala, around midnight? Why is it around midnight? So Rashi says kechatzai salala means that's just the way of describing midnight linguistically. Another possibility he suggests is that Moshe Rabbeinu was being intentionally vague because the Chartumim, the sorcerers, would suggest that Moshe Rabbeinu was false if it was not precisely at midnight. Now you have to think about that for a second, because you know in those days they did not have digital watches. They were using sundials, and sundials only really operate in the middle of the day. So that means to say, in their calculations from their day hours, they would have made a mistake. And the mistake, let's say, can't be so terrible. It must be, you know, a few minutes here or there. So imagine that all the firstborns in Egypt died according to their calculations at 12, you know, 12:05, if you would say it's a 12-hour night from 6 to 6. And so it's just after that midnight, and they would say, oh, well, Moshe was wrong. You have to imagine just how twisted the minds were of these Egyptians to make such an argument in the first place. But Moshe Rabbeinu is even avoiding that level of twisted rationalization which he could perhaps encounter. Another question to ask is, why is the last plague of the Makos Bechor is the capstone plague. Why is this the one that's chosen? So the first thing is, if you go back to Parshas Shmos, you remember that Hashem told Moshe before this all started that this would be the capstone plague. And the reason is because B'ni Bechori Yisrael, my firstborn is Israel. And therefore, I'm going to show you, if you're going to afflict my firstborn, my special child, says Hashem, I'm going to afflict your special child. So it's a measure for measure experience as well. Another expression is that this is the way that's going to affect every single Egyptian. There's not a single household, as we're going to see, that is going to be unaffected by this plague. So it's a way which reaches down to the entire culture, not just simply a rap on the knuckles for the leadership or for the economy. There's another idea here, a third idea, which is the Orach HaMakodesh. This is a remarkable idea, and that is that he explains that as galus, as exile is ending, there's a certain level of kedusha found even in what's called nitzotzots, which are these like sparks of light, which are found even in the deepest of darkest places called klipos. These shells, these vacuous areas in a complicated society. When Hashem was actually saving the nation of Israel, what was happening was he was drawing out the energy, the spiritual energy of life, from Egypt at that same point in time, which left those the power, so to speak, the power in Egypt evacuated of their energy and their power, which the resulting force was their death. But that ultimately was a reflection of this process of redemption, more than it was necessarily just killing them as well. Now, a few basic questions. Why the firstborn slaves were killed? Why were the Egyptian firstborn slaves were killed? Rashi says because they themselves afflicted the Hebrews, which means to say, you can imagine that the Hebrews were so low down in the totem pole that they were being afflicted by the slaves themselves. Why the firstborn animals? Rashi explains because they were served. They served animals, so Hashem was killing their gods as well, as we see later on. That Hashem says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroys their gods. We see a few examples of it later on as well. Now, the most important question really on earlier, which is the focus, is what is the significance of the first national mitzvah? This mitzvah of HaKadosh HaZalachim, it has two components. One is when we count the months from, and also Ibur HaChodesh, and perhaps even Ibur HaShana, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, which means ensuring that we have the right amount of days per month, because the lunar cycle is 29 and a half days, and ensuring that we match the solar and lunar calendars as well. Why is this the best mitzvah for first? Isn't, you know, belief in God, Kiddush Hashem, Shabbos, something more, you know, more relevant for the first national mitzvah? So it is important to understand. Rav Sorotzkin makes this point, which is that if you think about it, the world has been created now. It's already 2,000 years since creation, and the world's kind of been working and doing, but there's never been a why yet. There's never been a why. It's almost as if the creation, which occurred in Tishrei, was sort of what started the world off. That was the what. But for what purpose? Why are we here? What are we doing? Time only gained relevance and only gained direction at this point in time later on in creation. This was the why, where time, when you can control time and understand your place in it, that actually you validate with a why what the what is itself. Rashi takes us one step further as well, is the idea that if you look at Yom HaShishi in creation, Rashi says it's waiting for the time of the revelation of Sinai, a bit later on, because until we could have the Torah, until we received the Torah, the purpose, the why of the world had not yet been validated as well. So being able to take this world and make days on it, make them holy days, make them days of convocation, mo'adim, of times where we invite Hashem in, until such a point, then there is no why in the creation, and it's not worth existing until that we reach that point as well. Thomas Carlyle would say, a man without purpose is like a ship without a rudder, a waif, a nothing, a no man. Have a purpose in life, and having it, throw your such strength of mind and muscle into your work as God has given you. That quotation. Another perspective of this, of course, is that the Ramban explains that this is a revolution in the way we look at time, because time, in fact, was counted from creation. The months were dated back to creation. This is a restart of the calendar cycle, which means that they are now going to be called, the months are going to be called Chodesh Rishon, Chodesh Sheni, Chodesh Shlishi, till the exodus from the month of what we call Nisan today, which means say Hashem is reorienting our focus of time around the exodus experience itself, which is what's happening here. The Ramban then goes on to say that every exile that we come out of, we bring with it the, so to speak, our experience of time with it. So when we left Egypt, we started counting Chodesh Rishon, Chodesh Sheni, Chodesh Shlishi from Exodus. But when we left Babylon, we took the names of the months from Babylon itself, which is why we have the months we call Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, which are in fact Babylonian expressions. Reflect the latest exile that we had went through then. Another question you can ask us is, why are all this, there's so many mitzvahs which relate to Pesach, Korban Pesach, Chometz, Matzah. In fact, if you look at there's Bal Yeroi, there's Bal Yemotz, you can't see, you can't have Chometz, you have to destroy Chometz, Tashbish, you cannot eat Chometz, you can't eat a mixture of Chometz. There's so many mitzvahs around Chometz and Matzah and Korban Pesach. Why so many minutia? And Sefer Chinuch writes, as the Sefer Chinuch is actually a letter written from a father to a son at the time of his bar mitzvah, summarizing the 613 mitzvahs, and he explains that the reason is because that in order to be able to, he's trying to explain to his son who's becoming a teenager the importance of actions and repeated actions. And he says that if you want to be able to change your emotions and change the way you think and feel about something, you need to keep doing it. Essentially, 800 years ago, talking about behavioral psychology, just keep repeating something in order to be able to feel that something as well. And that's why he says to his son, on the flip side, if you think you can go to bars on Motzei Shabbos and hang out with the wrong people and doesn't have an impact, don't underestimate the power of actions as well. And that's why the Torah goes to such minutia with all these different details. Another question over here is, why the 4-day wait for the Korban Pesach? Why is there to take this lamb, this goat, and put it in their bedroom for these 4 days, and then shecht it, then slaughter it? So Rashi says, because they were naked of all mitzvahs. They did not have any mitzvahs. Hashem gave them two sacrifices to make. One was Bris Milah, one is a circumcision, and the other one is Korban Pesach, both bloods. And in fact, putting the blood on the doorpost is a sign of the mitzvah that they had done, which would protect them, because they had no mitzvahs. They were so culturally barren at this point in time from anything what we call Jewish today. So this actually is interesting in terms of why they would keep this lamb, because the Bris Milah, we understand, is a certain degree of physical and suffering and pain. But what's the sacrifice that's involved when it comes to the Korban Pesach? The answer is that the Egyptians served these animals. In fact, recently, just a few years ago, I read an article in the New York Times, which was about a mob attack in India, where a group of 1,000 men in India, Hindus, found a cow which they thought had been killed in a particular village in Bizara, India, and they went to a house of a Muslim, and his name was Muhammad Ikhlaq, and they lynched him right there. They killed him and crushed the skull of his son, because they thought the cow, that they without any evidence, they thought that this person was responsible for the killing of their cow, which was their deity. And you can imagine that if the Israelites, who are a minority in Egypt, were taking lambs and tying them to the beds, telling people that they're going to sacrifice them in 4 days, this was essentially a death warrant for the Israelites. The amount of sacrifice necessary to do this is something which is almost unimaginable, which is the zchus of this mitzvah, which protects them as well. Finally, one last question, this aliyah, is what's this aversion to chametz? Why is there so much focus on the unleavened bread? So Rashi explains that there are many different explanations, but one explanation is that this is the bread of affliction. So we're supposed to remember the bread of affliction, but others, as we get towards the end of this parak, we're also going to see that it's also the bread of freedom, not just slavery, but running out without time for it to rise. So remember both of those when commemorating Pesach. However, there's more to it than that. There's many other symbolisms of it. The Maharal in Gvuras Hashem explains that the idea of lechem oni, of this poor man's bread, is not just poor man's bread, but simple bread. Poor man means poor, is in simple in ideas, which means that all it has is flour and water, and not even thyme, no eggs, no spices, no cinnamon, no sugar, no nothing else, because it's simplicity. And to be free is being simple, not having all these extra additions in our lives, which we have to quite care for and think about. Less complexity is real freedom, which is why the focus on this. With this, we close this aliyah. In the meantime, have a wonderful and